You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning to you all. Thank you for joining us this morning on our panel on refugee integration and the Global Compact for Refugees and lessons from Turkey. I'm Kemal Kirişçi, the director of the Turkey Project at the Center for United States and Europe. These days, the attention of the media is on what's going on in the northwestern corner of Syria. We don't intend to go into that. But at the same time, I think the issue of the Syrian refugees in Turkey, but also in the frontline states, countries, remain a focus of attention. And we also need to bear in mind that the 5.4 million refugees, Syrian refugees, who are in Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey mostly, and some in Iraq and Egypt, only constitute about a quarter of the refugees around the world. There is a protracted refugee crisis in the world at the moment. One striking aspect of this protracted refugee crisis is that most of the refugees tend to be in urban centers and in city contexts. This is most visible in Turkey. More than 90%, actually 93-94% of the 3.4 registered Syrian refugees are in urban centers. Only a small minority remains in about 24-25 refugee camps. To add to the 3.4 million refugees, there is another 500,000 refugees of different nationalities in Turkey awaiting to be processed by the state authorities and the UNHCR. So Turkey is providing protection to more than 4 million refugees. In the context of the Turkish experience, we are also going to focus on the efforts of the international community to put together this Global Compact for Refugees. Its origins go back to the UN Summit on Refugees and Migrants that was held in September 2016. What is interesting about the declaration that was adopted at that summit is the focus that is put on enhancing refugee resilience. That's the technical term they use, what in effect means encouraging host countries to give refugees access to their labor market so that they can acquire a degree of independence. A second principle or a goal is to improve social cohesion in the host countries because, as a very recent international crisis group report on the Turkey case shows, there is a lot of compassion fatigue as well as tension between local communities and refugees. And the declaration aims to address this issue by emphasizing the importance of encouraging social cohesion. And then what I like the most about the declaration is this notion of a whole-of-society approach, meaning the international community, when lending their support, they ought to go beyond just refugees, but lend support to the communities that are hosting them and encourage the increase of their resilience, the community's resilience to handle and host the refugees. One major reason why we thought we ought to have this event is not only I will be introducing the panelists that we had the opportunity to host Murat Erdoğan, my friend and colleague, it's also that the process that has been put into place to arrive to this compact, and Beth Ferris will be elaborating briefly on it, lacks two voices. One voice is the voice of municipalities, cities that host most of these refugees. There is some progress being made on it, and my friend and colleague Jessica Brand, who is with us, together with her colleague Lucy Earle, just put out a brief on this with some really solid, interesting recommendation on what could be done in the remaining time before the compact is concluded and adopted. There are some copies of it available at the desk right outside the hall. The voice of MENA countries, meaning the voice of those countries, Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon, is missing in this exercise, or is not receiving the attention that it deserves. And we hope with this discussion today, we may contribute constructively to that exercise there. I'd like to start by introducing to you Professor Murat Erdoğan. I know this is a classic line, but we are really lucky to have him with us today, because he has enormous field experience. And when I say enormous field experience, I mean experience with civil society in Turkey, both local civil society as well as international and non-governmental organizations. He has a lot of experience with local governments. Jessica will like to hear that. He has actually published a report on what local governments around Istanbul, where more than 500,000 of the refugees are located, have been trying to do, and what are some of the challenges. But one reason, particular reason why we're lucky to have him, is that he has completed a major survey, public opinion survey, of both the Turkish public, but also refugees, and how they perceive each other and how they look at the situation they are in. And that survey, the Turkish version is published, the English summary is available, but there will be a fully fledged book coming out of it. Then we also have Iza Legdas with us. Iza is a good friend, good colleague, a senior advocate at the Refugees International, focusing on Europe, but particularly Turkey. She too has field experience in Turkey, has been there a number of times, has published reports based on her experiences. But she also has a background doing these, addressing these issues to do with refugee human rights, with the Human Rights Watch, as well as Amnesty International. And what I like the most is that she has also worked with the Court of European Justice and does have a solid legal grounding, and you'll hear about it. And then I have my good friend, colleague, Beth Ferris. She is right now a research professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Services, the Institute for the Study of International Migration. We are really fortunate. You know, Murat knows the Turkey field, Iza knows the Turkey field, but the broader legal context. And I think Beth must be one of those few people that have really deep experience and feel for the international context. And she was a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretary General, who prepared the summit in September 2016, and I know she's been working very closely with the UN in putting this Global Compact for Refugees together. Having made these introductory remarks, I'd like to start with Murat. The integration of refugees, Murat, is an issue particularly of deep concern to Europe. European countries, especially Germany, rightly, is very concerned about it, and the element of integration is very much embedded in the European Union Turkey migration deal that was struck in 2016. What I sense in this integration debate in Europe, and also implicit in the deal, is this kind of assumption that that because Syrian refugees are overwhelmingly Muslims, they are more likely to be integrated smoothly into the societies where the majority predominantly are Muslims. Is this really the case? What is your survey telling us about the integration challenges that a country like Turkey is facing with Syrian refugees?
Thank you very much for the invitation, first of all. And integration issue is very complicated, and I have a lot of experience about the Turks in European countries and diaspora politics and integration problems. And as director of migration and political research center at Hacettepe University, we're concentrated on the diaspora politic and then, of course, the integration issue. It is not easy thing. As you know, in Germany, after the unification of the both German side, they have also integration problems. I mean, the Wessies, Ossies, etc. And in Turkey, with Syrians, the main problem is the decision of the government. Actually, you know, our government doesn't want to make any integration policy, because it is not only a humanitarian problem, but also the political problem. And the number of the Syrian refugees is really too big, and now the recent number, the registered number, is 3.4 million. And it is very difficult to accept that they stay in Turkey forever, and then we should make integration policy. Because of that, for the government and then for the officials, it is very difficult to accept and then create integration policies. And then in social field, I mean, the Turkish society and then Syrian society, it was the image, actually. They are coming from our neighbor country, and then they are Muslim, and then Sunni, of course. And it's also a big advantage for the easily integration policy. But in our survey, we have another figures, and then it is also for us surprising. The Turkish society want to help to Syrian refugees, and they give also a lot of effort, but they don't want to share their future with Syrians. And the reaction of the citizenship was also a part of this issue. Erdogan is very important leader, and then he is also leading for this process. Instead of that, his policy for the citizenship is changed, and now only 38,000 Syrian refugees get Turkish citizenship. Now we have the second attempt, and then maybe we will have at about 50,000 more. But last 2 weeks, we discussed in Turkey another issue because of the Afrin operation and then new tendency in the region. Erdogan said that we made this operation not only for the terrorism, but also the refugees. They should go back, and then we will send them back. Of course, this mentality and this concept will make more difficult to make any integration policy. As I said, it is a governmental part, I mean the institutional part, but in social context, it will be also not easy. Traditionally, the Arabs and then Turks see each other not always the same one, actually. We have a survey. We ask very simple question. Are we similar culturally similar to the Syrians, Turkish society say no, 80%. It is too much, actually. It was 4 years ago, 70%, now 80%. And it is also very interesting, very significantly. If we ask this question in the border cities, even their relatives and then the relationship is very, very intensive, etc., they said that we are not similar. The percentage is more than 82%. It is strange, of course, but it is a reaction of the Turkish society. It is clear we are very similar, culturally very similar, but it shows us how big is the reaction in the society in Turkey. It will be not easy for the government, and integration policy is an acceptance for the staying of the refugees. It is also very hard for government because this our refugee policy is a part of the Syrian policy, and the government doesn't want to accept they will stay in Turkey forever, and then it will be also for the political discussion not good for the government. Because of that, we ignore that they stay in Turkey. As a migration expert, I have no doubt for that. They will stay in Turkey forever. It is not depend on the war in Syria and the other. They are more than 7 years in Turkey. We have in Turkey daily more than 306 new babies, Syrian babies. They are born in Turkey, and they work already in Turkey. More than 1 million Syrian work in Turkey as a cheap worker. They have houses, they have also their shops, etc. And one very important issue, Turkish government didn't make any settlement program, and they choose their place, their self, and they are in all Turkey, not only in the border region, but also in Istanbul, in Trakya, in Black Sea region, etc., in all part of the Turkey. It is not easy to collect them and then send them back. It is of course, not realistic. And for them, they are in our survey, we can also see that they are also almost happy in Turkey. I mean, 50% at least, they are happy to be in Turkey. And the situation in Syria is also very complicated. Nobody knows how long does it take, the war and then instability in the region, etc. And we have more than enough reason that they prefer to stay in Turkey. They have actually no other chance. In our survey, we say always, the social acceptance level in Turkey is extremely high till now. That's very important. But is it sustainable? It is the problem, actually. We ignore the problem. We have more than 3.4 million Syrians plus at about 500,000 non-Syrian refugees. Don't forget, we had only 58,000 refugees in 2011. Only 58,000. And now we are talking about 4 million. But in the reaction in the society, in the political field, it is also not too much. I mean, the society ignored the problem, actually. It is also maybe good for the refugees. But for a comprehensive strategy, for a plan, is very difficult. Mm-hmm. And as I said, because of the last development in the region and the new discourse of Erdogan and then government, would be very negative effect for the integration policy in Turkey, because
interrupt Murat in the 1 or 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. Why are you finding those results in your survey that suggest local people see this huge distance between mm-hmm. themselves mm-hmm. and the Syrian refugees? Are they sensing competition, or are they uncomfortable with the demand on public services? What's driving it?
Especially in border cities, of course, the public services is more difficult than before for the local people. It is very normal. In Chile, for example, their population is 110,000, and then now they have 130,000 refugees in the same city. And then we have a very centralistic system. Municipalities is traditionally very weak in Turkey, and they have also no money for the refugees. They have money only for the citizens. Mm-hmm. And then it makes also difficult to give them services, and then it brings also reactions. And it is, actually, it is not a, we have a tradition for the migration in Turkey. We get always the human mobility in Anatolia. But the number of the Syrians is really very huge. And we cannot realize that they stay in Turkey forever. And the secondly, I think it's a cultural things. It is from Ottoman Empire. We have also a distance to the Arabs. It's also a reality in Turkey. We cannot also ignore this reality.
Yeah. Thanks, Murat. We'll come back to you again. Iza, I think this is the right moment to address an issue that you cover in your report, which is access to livelihood. And I sense that there's a relationship between those public opinion survey results and the issue of access to the labor market. What do you see happening in Turkey? Were you able to detect some developments that you could consider to be positive in terms of helping the resilience of refugees? And then maybe what are some of the challenges, if you could share your observations with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So in a report that we published in December on access to employment for refugees in Turkey, and the title is I'm Only Looking for My Rights, and that's because the refugees feel that this is a right, basically, that is not, it's nothing more that they're asking, but it's still something they can't access. I'll start by saying, by talking a bit about, I think, what's not working, what the main challenges are. So Kamal was saying, there are at least 3.4 million Syrian refugees in Turkey, 500,000 Afghan refugees, Iranians, other nationalities. And so these people are in Turkey. They're not getting, some get some financial assistance, including from the EU, but it's not enough. So people work, they have to work. But the conditions that they work in are extremely difficult. So the majority work in the informal sector. This is not something that's foreign to Turkish workers, too. I mean, this is a big phenomenon in Turkey as well. But the experience of refugees in Turkey, generally speaking, is working in sectors such as construction, textiles, services, for example, restaurants, other types of services, and in very precarious conditions, but also very badly paid. So paid very low wages for very long hours. People told us they were working 12 hours, 14 hours, and then really it's up to the employer if they say, oh, it's not enough, you have to stay longer, and then not being paid for the extra time. Also very vulnerable in the sense that being dismissed like that without any notice, accidents at work where they wouldn't get their wages for that time, and then also they don't have any social security coverage. And something that was very common in what people were saying was that it was really hard for them even to get their salaries, even the low wages that they were supposed to get. It was really hard. The employers, if they didn't feel like it, they didn't pay them, and then they'd say, well, what are you going to do? You're going to go to the police. You're not working with a permit. So and to the extent that even there's an Afghan woman that we met who was talking about her daughter, who's actually a teenager, and she was saying that she works, she earns half of what her Turkish co-workers would earn. But she said, fortunately she receives her salary. So it's kind of like a luxury, a bonus, if you actually get paid. So we saw many people who had left a job because they weren't getting paid, but they were still chasing the employer to get their wages. Another problem is, this example of the teenager, is child labor. So about 40% of Syrian children in Turkey don't go to school. And one of the factors is that their parents just don't earn enough. So then children, work as well. There's also a factor that employers, we heard this a lot, especially in textiles, they actually like to employ children because they don't have to pay them as much. But this is very much a reality. And in families, we were given this figure that, pretty much in every family, there's at least one person working. And, often this involves children as well. So these are some of the some of the challenges. I will say that the opportunity, and another challenge following up on Murat was saying was this social context. So the tensions, people really struggling, even to rent an apartment, but it really goes in every aspect of their lives because they're Syrian, sort of feeling very stigmatized. And with a system of, I'll talk a bit about this, how they can actually be employed legally, but sort of very little appetite from employers also to hire them as refugees. And then in the context of this urban refugees, living in a big city like Istanbul, where, there's about 500,000, over 500,000 registered Syrians, but we were told there are up to 900,000 or a million refugees in Istanbul because not everyone is registered. And so it's an expensive city, so they go there because there are more job opportunities than in the southeast, but at the same time, it's very expensive to rent, the distances are big, it's a city of 14 million people, transportation they have to pay for, so there's all sorts of challenges. What's encouraging is that Turkey does have a system for the legal employment of refugees. It is something that exists. It's not automatic like we would like it to be in the sense of not requiring a work permit, but there is a system in place since early 2016. The problem is that it requires the employer to apply for the work permit. So this is not in the hands just of the refugee. The employer has to be willing. The employer has to pay a fee of over $130, and it's valid for a year. They also need to prove that there isn't a Turkish person that can do this job. So there are a lot of these hurdles and also administrative, bureaucratic issues that they have to face. And so this is why today, when we were in Turkey in October, we were given the figure of around 14,000 work permits since the beginning of 2016. It's not exactly clear what it covers because it may be people who were renewing their work permits, so it could actually be lower than that. So it's a pretty grim situation, but there is something to work with.
Mm-hmm. But you do... You do in the report also make references to what you nicely call innovative projects. Can you share one or two of those innovative, what they are and in what ways they do help Syrian refugees and in some ways also help to build bridges with the local community?
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. One thing I'll add in terms of the challenges is the language. So this is a really big problem for many refugees. They don't speak the language, and so they really need... It's not enough to have a system in place, not enough to have a law. There really needs to be extra steps and measures to support them. And so one initiative which I found very interesting is a non-profit organization in Istanbul that is funded and established by the Netherlands, the government of the Netherlands. And so this initiative basically is to try to match refugees who are looking for jobs with companies, so primarily Dutch companies, that are present in Turkey and around, in 2016, there were around 700 companies Dutch companies that had a presence in Turkey. So there's quite a lot to work with. And so basically the idea is to identify employers that are sympathetic, that are willing to employ refugees, either because they consider it part of their social responsibility or because it needs, there's a lot of unemployment in Turkey, but there's also a lot of jobs that aren't filled and the employers that are looking for the skills. And so what they do is they have a database, they have refugees applying, listing what their skills are, and then they try to match them with an employer who's willing to employ them, and then they take care of, the work permit process so that that's sorted, and then they give them trainings and then also a coaching after they start the job. So I just think it really illustrates how important it is to not just have a system in place. The reality is that refugees, like I said, they often don't speak the language, very hard for them to get the information, they have very sort of mixed information, not always reliable about what they have the right to, what the system is, how they can get what they have the right to. And so these kinds of initiatives also of matching the private sector, with these, with the livelihoods of the refugees, I think is really encouraging.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Thanks, Isa. Beth, my request now is to build that bridge between this Turkish experience and the efforts of the international community to put that global compact for refugees. What are lessons that could be carried onto that exercise, given that the voice of Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan has remained somewhat meek in that exercise. But I think before we get there, I'll try to get you kill two birds with one stone. Could you briefly tell us, remind the participants of what this exercise is about and what are the stages? I hear a lot that we've entered the final stretch. Thanks, Beth.
Okay, thanks. It's great to be back at Brookings. Let me say a word about these processes because there's a lot of confusion, including in the media. In September 2016, the Global Summit on Refugees and Migrants came up with the New York Declaration, unanimously approved 193 countries, making some wonderful promises. Promises to open alternative pathways for migrants and refugees, to resettle more refugees, to adopt better conditions, to respect their rights, and so forth. But that New York Declaration also called for the development of two new global compacts, one on migration and one on refugees. These are very different processes. The Global Compact on Migration, which we're not talking about here, is a state-led process being negotiated between governments in New York under the authority of the President of the General Assembly. Two skilled diplomats are leading that process, Mexico and Switzerland. The Global Compact on Migration is a more complex process than the Global Compact on Refugees. There are more issues. There are strong tensions between protecting the rights of migrants and border control, border management. And so that is a very interesting process to watch. The process for coming up with a Global Compact on Refugees is very different. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, was given the responsibility for developing this compact in consultation with governments, not to be negotiated, but UNHCR in the driver's seat to consult with governments to come up with a draft that will then be presented to the General Assembly in fall 2018 and presumably adopted. There's a lot of clear recommendations, particularly in the annex to the New York Declaration, of what is to be included in that global compact. There will be six rounds of consultations with governments between February 13th and the middle of July. And so we can expect to have a lot of discussion of what should be included and how far to go. The zero draft of the Global Compact on Refugees is expected tomorrow, 31st of January. So it'll be interesting to see how UNHCR, which is drafting that compact, picks up what it has heard from governments through some of the individual consultations. Now, when you look at the relationship between this Global Compact on Refugees and issues of integration, it's kind of hard to see the relationship. The New York Declaration makes 11 references to integration, but 9 of those are to integration of migrants. When it comes to refugees, the relevant phrase is the reintegration of refugees when they return. The fact is that integration in the refugee world is becoming almost a non-starter. Traditionally, there have been 3 solutions for refugees: voluntary return, local integration, or resettlement. Voluntary repatriation isn't happening anywhere in large numbers. Resettlement is being slashed in terms of the possibilities. And governments of host countries, for the most part, are not interested in local integration. I mean, Lebanon, Jordan, even Turkey, accepted refugees to arrive, understanding it would be temporary. So did the refugees. They thought it would be a few months. And here it is 7 years later. But a lot of policies explicitly prohibiting integration. We want you to go home, therefore we're not going to make life particularly easy for you in the host countries. Now, there are exceptions. Uganda stands out as a very generous country that has had good integration policies. But by and large, this is a trend we see everywhere. How far can the Global Compact on Refugees go in terms of promoting integration, when some of the frontline countries, those hosting millions of refugees are saying no to integration. So that's one issue to watch for. Another issue to watch for in the development of this global compact on refugees is the concept of responsibility sharing or burden sharing or the more generic international cooperation. You know, we're not facing a crisis of refugee numbers. 22 million refugees in the world of 7 billion people should not be a crisis. A million arriving in Europe should not be a crisis in a region with 650 million people. But the crisis in the system is there's no good way of sharing responsibility so that governments of frontline countries don't feel beleaguered like they're left on their own. The extent to which the Global Compact on Refugees can move us forward in terms of responsibility sharing is certainly something to look out for. And then finally, this notion you mentioned, Kamal, about whole-of-society approach. How do you mobilize different actors and stakeholders, not just national governments, but municipalities? And here I would really point to Turkey's experience with the crucial role of governors in terms of responding to refugees in their situations. But parliamentarians, civil society, private sector, you know, it all sounds very nice to say everybody should be working together. But how does that work in practice? You know, how do you involve the private sector beyond urging them to provide jobs for refugees or IDPs or returning refugees? You know, how can their contributions be valued more? And similarly, what role can mayors play? And I applaud the brief that just came out, you know, calling for those drafting and consulting on the Global Compact on Refugees to consider the voices of mayors. I suspect there's a lot more optimism there than negotiating or consulting with national level governments.
Thanks, Beth. Whenever I listen to you, I wish I was in your graduate class and able to take notes before you know what you're saying disappears out of my memory. But brilliant. Thanks a lot. And I really appreciated the way you distinguished between the Global Compact for Migrants versus the Global Compact for Refugees. And to see that one international governmental organization, UNHCR, have been given the responsibility, I think ought to be seen as something very positive. But then I know we mustn't count our chicken before we get there. You mentioned rightly the challenge of burden sharing. What I like about the declaration, the New York Declaration, the emphasis it puts on how protecting refugees is a global responsibility. It's a shared responsibility. And there I'd like to turn back to you, Murat. Part and parcel of that burden sharing that sometimes doesn't receive the recognition that it deserves in Turkey is the migration deal that was agreed upon between Turkey and the European Union. The impression we get from the media is that the leg of the deal that meant to control the movement of Syrian refugees towards Europe is working reasonably well. And the Europeans, though they don't mention it too much, are quite happy and comfortable with it. But one of the other legs is that the European Union means to support the efforts of Turkey to integrate or manage the refugee situation. And when the deal was struck, I remember at the time the narrative was not very positive. You know, it was made to sound like the European Union was paying protection money to Turkey, whereas from the discussion we've had so far, there's a lot of effort that is being put into managing the Syrian refugee presence in Turkey. Obviously, as Isa has pointed out, there are difficulties, there are challenges, there are inadequacies. But Murat, you're right there in the field. How do you see that burden-sharing part of that deal working in Turkey. What reflections can you share with us, and what more could be done?
Turkish-EU relationship is always very important, but last 5 years we discussed with European only the refugee issue, not the other things. Mm-hmm. It's also actually very sadly for Turkish politics and then for the link to the Western community. I define the agreement between Turkey and EU an agreement between three losers. Turkey is losers, EU losers, and then also refugees is losers. It is not ideal, but the main effect is the money. And money is $3 billion, as you know, for 2 years. And then maybe we will have also $3 billion for next 2 years. But it is also another discussion in Turkey. And I think this discussion brings a lot anti-Western, anti-European tendencies in Turkey. And then it brings also, it is also an instrument for the anti-Western politicians in Turkey. The money is important, of course. Till now, Turkish government said that we pay $30 billion U.S. dollar. Of course, it's a discussion we cannot describe. I am sure the Turkish government not pay $30 billion, but it is, there are some direct costs and then indirect costs. A refugee cost in European Union, 15,000 euro per year. If you make a calculation, if the Syrian refugees, not in Turkey, but were in European Union, in Germany, for example, then it would be cost more than 150 billion euros. Actually, the cost is enormous. But in Turkey, the problem is, first of all, the transparency. We have no idea which money and then which sector and then which mechanism, etc. It is the main problem in Turkey in all sectors, actually. It's not only for the refugees issue. But we make also a wrong calculation. Refugee cost is enormous, and then I am sure it is more than 50 billion till now for the Turkey. And then the money is a part, the other risk is more bigger. I mean, what about the social risks and economic risks and the security risks, etc. And for the burden sharing in all together, we as Turks maybe have always, first time see the reality, how weak is the burden sharing and then the responsibility sharing and then solidarity. The lack of the solidarity is the one of the biggest issue. And as Turkey, we can also recognize. But what is the problem now in Turkey? We get $3 billion, but we can use only $1 billion in Turkey from the EU money, because we should also create our own projects. It's also very problematic. We cannot create easily our project because of our policy. Until now, we didn't decide what will we do. I mean, shall we send them back or give them citizenship or send them to Europe, etc., etc. We lost time, we lost money, we lost energy, of course. And then it brings also, as I said, anti-Western and then anti-European discourse more stronger. It's very important. And maybe one word about the Elizabeth's burden sharing and then global compact. As you know, Oxfam in Turkey, they try to bring more voice of the refugee hosting countries. It's also another big issue. And then we should also give more effort for that. But the EU-Turkey relationship is now, unfortunately, based only on the refugee issue. Mm-hmm. And it brings also negative effect. And then it brings also more suspicions for the integration policy. If you European brings money for the education, for women, for entrepreneurship, et cetera, then Turks and the Turkish government say that, yeah, you see, they bring money to send them or to let them all in Turkey. It is the problem in Turkey. It's a psychological problem in Turkey also. One word also about the work permit. Okay, they have work permit possibility, but it cannot working. It is not easy. We have in Turkey very high unemployment rate, more than 3.5 million Turkish citizens waiting for job places. And informality is unfortunately part of the Turkish economy. More than 35% of the Turks work informal. And for the refugees, it is impossible to get formal work, a good work, decent work. It is very problematic, but it is also not sustainable. It is also a very big danger for our next future for the integration policy, because it brings also hate speech, not only among the Turks, but also the Syrians. It will be in future big problem. We have as a cheap worker, the Syrians in Turkey, they bring maybe some contribution to the Turkish economy, but it is not sustainable, and then it is very risky, mm-hmm. I have to say. Yeah.
Thanks, Murat. My feeling has always been on the EU-Turkey deal is the importance of the narrative that is used around it. It's for domestic political reasons, both sides tend to adopt a negative discourse. And the losers, I like, Murat, the way you pointed out, Turkey loses, EU loses, and the refugee losers. But one outcome, a product of that kind of negative narrative, at the top of the list are refugees. It's not that the European Union is not providing funds. Mm-hmm. It is providing funds. And then the international community is providing funds. Actually, these funds can be Googled. You know, it's transparent. It's open. And what's striking is that the overwhelming part of those international funds actually come from the West, come from the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Europe, and a very small proportion comes from countries beyond that. I don't see, for example, China contributing. I don't see Russia contributing. But when you look at the Turkish narrative, especially governmental narrative, it's the West that is constantly being criticized. And then it's no wonder that the West adopts a negative narrative, often driven by their own domestic politics, which is very much these days centered around anti-immigrants, xenophobia, and Islamophobia. And you get trapped in this vicious circle that is not benefiting any of the parties that are that you are referring to. And I'll turn to Isa, but Beth, I wonder if in the Global Compact for Refugees exercise, there could be, it's just a thought that came up to my mind, an exercise where there's an effort to address this narrative issue, this discourse issue. But Isa, in between you and Beth and me, following up on Murat's remarks, how can we overcome this fear on the part of the local communities that they are taking away our jobs? And it would not surprise me that the negative results from the Turkish public opinion survey is mostly driven by this fear of losing jobs. And you've just heard Murat making references to how the informal sector in Turkey is very large. And in an informal sector, that fear is accentuated. It's exaggerated. It grows. What do we do? What kinds of ideas can we come up with to mitigate that fear and to control it?
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, it's a question of education. I mean, when you have so many myths about, you know, Syrians, they don't want to work, they're lazy, they get loads of money from the state, they get into universities without exams. I mean, there's a lot of these just inaccurate and negative perceptions that are not by no means limited to Turkey. I mean, there's a lot of myths that are going around in Europe and in the States as well about who refugees are and, you know, what they want and how, if they're living at the cost of the state. So I think first of all, explaining that there needs to be a strong messaging on the behalf of the authorities to correct these and explain, you know, this is who refugees are, this is why they're here, they work, they have to work like anyone else, and also bringing, you know, opportunities. Basically, the issue of legal employment is really key, because there are a number of refugees, obviously, who have low skills or who are more suited to this kind of informal work. But there are also people with qualifications, with university degrees, but they end up doing these jobs and competing with less qualified Turkish citizens because they just don't have the opportunity to work in the field that they're most qualified for. And so then you get into this competition between people who are overqualified with, you know, and then that also drives down the salaries. What I was saying, that the pretty much all the refugees that we've been speaking to, they earn less. They say they earn less than the Turks. So obviously, if you're a Turkish person, then yeah, it's more competitive. It drives down the salaries. So it's really important to address and to listen, you know, to listen to the concerns. I think there's a concern about the lack of transparency, who's getting citizenship, why are they getting citizenship, you know, these kinds of things. So I think involving the local population, listening, but also informing them and creating opportunities for people to work side by side, to live side by side in ways that are respectful, because I think this is, again, not just a lesson for Turkey, everywhere. If you get people together, it becomes a more human interaction than just kind of news and numbers, and that, I think, can help a lot.
Many thanks, Isa. Mm-hmm. I think you put it so vividly, what can be done and what's driving these fears, the myths, and the need to educate. When we were in Şanlıurfa, one of the cities along the border with Syria, I remember hearing this dilemma that businesses have, where one business who wants to run the business by the book, but then the business next to it is not doing it, and it's employing people illegally or informally, and then the business that is wants to do things correctly is beginning to lose out in the market, because the other one has the competitive edge. And I think clearly there the role of regulatory bodies is very critical, and then it ties back to your point about transparency. But how do we get these ideas, especially the one that just popped up in my mind, the notion of how could we weave into the compact the importance of governments, particularly governments? I don't know if Jessica would agree with me or disagree. I have this feeling from what I read and the conversations I hear, municipalities tend to adopt a more constructive language. We see it in the United States too. I mean, there's a battle going on between the federal government and cities over immigration issues. Do we still have any chance of weaving such ideas into the preparation of the compact and
Two points on the toxic narrative that we're living in with respect to both refugees and migrants. It makes it extraordinarily difficult to be negotiating or developing these new global compacts when public opinion across the board is so negative. On the other hand, it's an unprecedented opportunity to try to move the system a little bit forward. But, you know, so I think we need to be very careful about our expectations that these global compacts aren't going to resolve all problems. But the other thing is, I wonder how much we know about public opinion and what contributes to it. I mean, research shows pretty clearly, at least in the U.S. and Europe, that confronting myths or stereotypes by presenting evidence doesn't seem to work. Mm. People have their minds made up, and I can cite a dozen studies showing the tremendous economic contributions of refugees, but they don't go very far. I mean, how do people's attitudes change? I think political leadership is key. You know, when the messages come from the top that refugees and migrants are opportunities, that they're positive, they should be welcomed, for Americans, this is who we are in terms of our national identity. The other thing that seems to be helpful are personal contacts. when people know a refugee, when they've talked to them, when they've heard their stories, usually over things like kids in school together rather than structured conversations, people tend to have more positive attitudes. But in so some of the restrictions on freedom of movement in refugees in host countries limit those possibilities to get to know ordinary human beings on a normal basis, which may be a contributor to public opinion. I don't think that the global compacts will be able to do much more than say, call on political leaders to say positive things about refugees and migrants, maybe note the importance of public opinion. But I think it's really hard work to understand how public opinions are formed and how they can be changed. The words in a global compact aren't going to make a lot of difference, I don't think.
Yeah. Thanks for the warning, Beth, and injecting an element of realism for an idea that popped up to my mind at the spur of the the moment. Reality check is always a very useful one. Well, thank you for the initial remarks, and I'd like to take this opportunity to involve you in the discussion and encourage you to raise questions with the panel, make comments, but please first present yourselves. The way we thought we would proceed is to have two or three initial questions and comments, and then I'll turn to the panel. The floor is yours. Yes, ma'am, please. You have the microphone.
Oh, thank you. Do children born to refugees in Turkey automatically become citizens?
Very good. I'll take one.
Okay.
Thanks. Kathleen, please.
Thanks. Just a couple of things, and this one is probably for Beth. The High Commissioner for Refugees seems recently to have been placing a lot more emphasis on relations with host communities and support to host communities. And I think in Murat's surveys, it was pointed out that that assistance that goes exclusively to refugees can inflame resentment against them. So I wonder how you, perhaps any of you, but you particularly, Beth, think that this kind of emphasis can be promulgated not only through the Global Compact but through other mechanisms. Thanks.
Thanks. One more before I thank you, sir.
Thank you very much to the speakers for their excellent insights. I'm Terence Taylor from the International Council for Life Sciences. Mm. Rightly, the discussion has been focused on the intergovernmental relations, but I wonder if there are any lessons from the experience in Turkey for both international and national non-governmental organizations, which can provide, you know, not only funds, of course, the larger organizations, but also expertise, perhaps more focused on the management of refugees rather than the integration aspects. I'd be grateful for any comments. Thank you.
Murat, let's start with you with a very specific question, which I have also very much wondered what's happening to the status of those children. And then you're welcome to address Kathleen's as well as the final question there.
Okay.
Then I'll turn to you.
Citizenship is in Turkey, unfortunately, not depends on the geography, but also the other status. In Zoom, we have till now, after 2011, April, till today, we have more than 305,000 babies. They were born in Turkey, but they have no citizenship. And they have another big problem. They have also no Syrian citizenship.
Yes.
They are stateless now. And it will be a big problem in future. We discuss also in Turkey, but due to the political situation in Turkey, it's very difficult and very risky for the government to give them citizenship. We gave them exceptional citizenship, but as I said, it is not more than 50,000. Another second question, if you give them the citizenship, then what about the their fathers, parents, etc.? It will be very, very difficult. And the reaction is too hard, not only from the opposition party, but also Erdogan's party. And because of that, they are very, very, delicately.
Careful.
Careful for that, sorry. And then second, Global Compact, maybe you will say much better than me. For the non-governmental organizations and then cooperation in Turkey, it is another very big problem in Turkey now. It is difficult to be active in Turkey as an NGO and then even as UN institutions in Turkey, unfortunately. Last 5 years, we have not good experience. They are very active, but the problem is that the mentality of the NGOs and then UN institutions for the refugee issue, they depends on their mentality depends on the very poor country, and then their structure is no more there, etc. It's Afghanistan or Zimbabwe or Uganda, etc., etc. But in Turkey, the government is very strong, and then also the local authorities is very, very strong. I mean, the governorship, etc., etc. They want to control all of them. It's very difficult to make cooperation with the international organization. And secondly, it is not easy region, actually. We have a lot of problems, terrorism, and then the other political problems, it's ISIS and the PKK and the other. Then it's a security problem for Turkey to make cooperation with the international organizations. It is one of the biggest challenges for Turkish government and then also the for the refugees. We should create another environment for the cooperation. They bring not only money, but the capacity. It's very important, very valuable. As I said, we cannot forget. In 2011, only 58,000 refugees, now more than 4 million. Then we need also capacity. But it is also the same time and political discourse. And then secondly, the Turkish government and then bureaucrats is also they don't want to accept to make cooperation because they see a trick of the Western organization to let the refugees in Turkey. That's another big barrier in Turkey.
Thanks, Murat. Unfortunately, the last element is a very difficult one. For good or bad reasons, there is a deep mistrust towards the West. I would argue part of it is a function of Turkish politics, Turkish discourse, culture, but part of it is also the manner in which the West and especially the European Union has handled Turkey over the decades, and in particular the accession challenge, membership to the European Union. But that's a topic for hopefully another occasion. Iza, to go back to the lessons and as well as Kathleen's point about host communities, can you reflect on it a bit from your perspective? Because I remember one of your colleagues, within the very few months I had arrived here, I got a chance to have a conversation with Daryl and a colleague of hers, and they had just come back from Turkey, and they had made exactly the remark that Murat made and flagged that they noticed out in the field that representatives of well-meaning international non-governmental organizations were having that difficulty to adjust moving from their experiences in countries where states may be relatively weaker to a state like in Turkey, where sometimes we feel the state is too strong.
I agree, and I think that was an issue that came up in Greece as well, but with the arrival of a large number of refugees, and then a lot of NGOs moved from other countries and other contexts into Greece. So you know, it's not the only context in which this is happening. I mean, I do think it is a difficult climate and a difficult context for NGOs to operate in, not just international NGOs, but also Turkish NGOs. And for example, the issue of language, which I think is really key for refugees like we've been discussing. I mean, it's the seventh year now of the Syria crisis, and so with people still not speaking the language, it's extremely problematic. But now there are more stringent requirements. While NGOs were providing Turkish lessons, not necessarily on a very formal basis, but a number of them had to stop doing that because the requirement has become in 2017 that the organization has to have a protocol with the government, with the Ministry of Education, with an approved curriculum and everything. But what this means is it's less languages provided to the refugees, and in a context where we're talking about large numbers, large populations in big urban centers, it's really important to have these services close to the refugees. So I think this is another thing we can learn. A city like Istanbul of 14 million, you just have to have more localized services, and especially when people are working 12 hours a day, they're not going to go and travel another hour and a half to take a Turkish language lesson. So they kind of get trapped in this context, and without this communication being possible between them and a host community, I think it's very difficult.
Thank you. Beth, how do you... what's your experience, with respect to INGOs, IGOs, and the local governments and local communities?
Well, first on Kathleen's question about working with the host community and refugees, that's become standard good practice in non-camp situations. A lot of people still think of refugees as living in camps where services are delivered exclusively to refugees. But more and more NGOs, UN agencies are realizing that to separate out refugees can cause a lot of tension with the host communities and not meet the needs of people living there. With respect to INGOs and local NGOs, I think Turkey has some very good, strong local national NGOs that are playing a leading role in a lot of areas. And I think that we can learn from that. We haven't mentioned the situation of IDPs or internally displaced persons, and I kind of have to mention that. Mm. But inside Syria, there are over 6 million people displaced. And there at least some Turkish NGOs have played an important role in providing some cross-border assistance to people who may be in even more vulnerable situations than refugees. Tensions sometimes between INGOs and local NGOs about money. Why should a government give a big NGO, an international NGO, funds, which then distributes it often to local partners or local NGOs, but always taking a part of that for its administrative costs? So some tension from local NGOs saying, why don't you just give us the money directly? And there are a lot of reasons why, particularly donor governments, would prefer to work through established international NGOs than to work with entities that they may not know nothing about and don't want to take the risk of inadvertently funding a politically motivated or worse type of organization.
Yeah. And an added element to what you just said, which sometimes is difficult to get across in Turkey, is that these big donors have to account to their own publics, that they have to be transparent. And I personally have had great difficulties in trying to explain this to my Turkish counterparts. It's time for another round of questions. Yes, ma'am, please. And then there. Yes. Here, yeah, you go ahead. Let's take... Okay. Yeah, and then we'll come to the front.
Thanks. Alan Makovsky with Center for American Progress.
I recognize the voice there. I don't see the face.
I recognize yours, too. I wanted to ask Murat, you mentioned that the Operation Afrin is being talked about in part as an opportunity to repatriate some of the refugees. I think Operation Euphrates Shield, which took place in 2016, 2017, to the east of Afrin, also was talked about that way. And I think the Turkish government has claimed that some people have been repatriated. I wonder, what are the latest numbers on repatriation to the area of Euphrates Shield? What is the potential for repatriation in Afrin, if you know it? Also, just wanted to ask, given your work with the Syrian refugees, to what extent is there still hope for being able to go to the West? or have they largely given that up based on the EU Turkey agreement and the doors closed in Europe?
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, please, here. And then we'll come to you.
I have two quick questions. One is on education of refugee children. What are the barriers to entry to education? Turkey has an extremely high literacy rate, if I understand correctly, and you're suggesting, I think, that you have 4 million people whose children may or may not achieve that literacy, and they come from a country of high literacy originally. And the second question is has anybody done any comparisons between the success of Uganda and its contribution to its overall economy and the integration of refugees and migrants? Thank you.
Yes, please, here.
Thank you for an excellent panel. My first question is to Beth, I think. You mentioned that the three solutions for refugees are kind of failing, and I was wondering to what extent is the asylum process mentioned in the Global Compact, and to what extent could that be a legal way forward for integrating refugees? And my second quick question regards the EU-Turkey deal. It seems to me that this deal kind of shifts responsibility away from Europe and to Turkey just by giving money. Why not use that money to fund projects and programs in Europe that has, in general, a stronger institutional framework instead of just sending the money to Turkey, where you mentioned transparency is an issue?
There would be more of them coming. It wouldn't sell well. But I think this time, why don't we start with you?
I'm going to leave the questions for offering to you, Murad. In terms of some of the barriers to education, perhaps Isa can talk further. I mean, first there's language. There are concerns of parents for the safety of their children. Often they need their kids to work in terms of to contribute to income. I think that Turkey has done a pretty good job in terms of trying to make schools accessible to refugee children, and some concerns with establishing separate Syrian-run schools, some of the political concerns around that. I'm not sure. Isa may want to add some more of the barriers there. On the question of Uganda and studies on economic impact, I haven't seen any in the last year or so when the large number of refugees came. But across the board, the research is pretty clear that when policies are available to support the integration of refugees, the economic impact is better. And we talk about economic impact in terms of the cost to a country, but there are always winners. There are some very rich Turkish companies and Jordanian and Lebanese who've made a lot of money from the infusion of hundreds of millions of dollars of humanitarian aid. You know, I wish I were a SUV dealer in Beirut, for example, in terms of the number of NGOs buying cars and renting apartments. So we don't talk very much about the economic winners in this. Maybe we ought to give more attention to that. Asylum will definitely be mentioned in the Global Compact. They'll talk about the need for clear procedures, better conditions at entry, borders, et cetera. Asylum is another way of moving to other countries. But I think that there's not going to be ringing endorsement for more would-be refugees to take dangerous journeys to seek asylum on the borders of countries that really don't want them. That doesn't seem like a good solution. But what you hear a lot more of is the need for refugee self-reliance, refugee resilience, in a way that's saying, hey, the international community can't do this for you forever, so let's really emphasize you're doing it on your own. Refugee self-reliance will be a big theme, I'm sure, in the conference. It's politically very, very attractive. It's a nice word, self-reliance. But what it can mean is, you know, don't expect more or indefinite humanitarian aid.
On the SUV point, the World Bank did a very good study in, I think, 2015 or 16, looking at the impact of the Syrian refugees on the labor market of Turkey. Mm-hmm. Very professional study, discovering how educated Turks have seen their salaries increase because of demand for their services, while particularly women in the informal sector suffering from competition coming from the Syrian refugees. What I haven't seen so far, there may be one, and if anyone is aware of it, please flag it to me, is a study of precisely what Beth, through her remark on SUVs, alluded to. A lot of funds have, dare I say, flooded the Turkish economy. A lot of the humanitarian assistance, you know, from diapers to food to bed covers to tents, were actually purchased in Turkey and shipped into Syria. And I do remember once hearing the complaint that even the VAT on these items are paid for. And that makes a very significant contribution to the Turkish economy. I don't know how much of the cost that Murat made references to is compensated for through that, but I'd very much be interested on seeing the results of a study and being shared with the public to encourage a more positive view vis-a-vis the Syrian refugees. Isa, I know you would have quite a bit of words to share with us on education. Please take up the questions there.
Yeah, so the number is around 40% out of children, Syrian children out of school in Turkey. And I think I agree with Beth. I think there's the language challenge. But I think from the people that I've met, it's easier with young children. So families where children are just starting school, it's much easier. You know, they learn the language. They start from the beginning. You know, we've met very enthusiastic, like one man, a Syrian man in Istanbul we met. And he said his children had just started school that year, twins. He said the school starts at 12:30. He said at 11, they're already like with their bags ready. They're like, when can we go to school? You know, so I've very, very positive, even among Afghan families, not just Syrians. But I think it becomes much harder when children are older, when they've been out of school for a long time. And that's a challenge that needs to be tackled in a very different way. And then there's also, the issue of the livelihood. So basically children, particularly if they're a little bit older, having to work as well to support the family. If I may, on the issue of the EU-Turkey. Yeah. So I think it's really not a question in terms of your question about why are these funds not being used in the EU. That's not the purpose. The purpose is actually to control the borders. So it's a very political issue. It's after 2015 when up to a million people crossed, most of them from Turkey into the Greek islands. So I don't think that's an argument. I mean, the EU is spending a lot of money on border control, on cooperation with African governments to, you know, address what they call the root causes of migration, etc. So it's not really an economic issue, I think a financial issue. And I think that the money, it's a lot of money, 3 billion euros. I mean, it's not what the Turkish authorities are saying that they've spent, obviously, but it's not easy to absorb these large funds. I mean, 3 billion euros in 2 years, now discussing maybe another 3 billion. So it's one thing for the EU to be sort of, yes, well, we've paid our 3 billion, we've done our part, but it's a lot of money to absorb. It's procedures, it's programs, it's ministries that have to be accountable, etc. So, and I think that at the end of the day, it's still a lot of people, 3.5 or 7 million that we're talking about. So there's definitely a need. There are programs of resettlement to the EU. There's a one-for-one scheme under the EU-Turkey statement, which is for every Syrian returned to Turkey from the Greek islands, another Syrian to be resettled. They're not really applying it that way. So I think the numbers are disappointing, and they're definitely, you know, the people in Turkey need help because the reality is most of them are going to stay there. But there definitely needs to be more in terms of taking a number of people to the EU, but also to the US.
Yeah, give them some credit, the EU, and also Germany is funneling important funds and resources into integrating Syrian refugees and others who came along. But then I'd also like to voice the complaints of a neighboring country called Greece that is a member of the European Union, but is struggling with managing the very fact that other EU member countries have failed to express solidarity with Greece in respect to the relocation. They don't call it resettlement, but the relocation scheme. And you've seen some of the narratives, populist narratives that we are hearing coming out of Poland, Hungary, now the Czech Republic as well. This is domestically a very hot potato. But on education, Murat, before I turn to you for especially the Afrin question and as well as the other ones, there's something very interesting that links the education issue with your findings about cultural affinity. Mm-hmm. One of the massive, as far as I go as a former professor, gains of the Turkish Republic and the legacy of Atatürk, etc., is the way in which the Turkish education system is co-education. Boys and girls are educated in the same classroom. This legacy and tradition is beginning to take a dent, but that's a different issue. One challenge in the case of Syrian children is that the Syrian education system is segregated. And from reports, we are hearing that Syrian families are reluctant to send their daughters to Turkish schools for this very reason. And it's a very difficult issue in terms of finding a way out from that the dilemma. Although if this lasts long enough, then the Turkish education system might become one where girls and boys are separated and the challenge is resolved there. And to add one point very quickly to what Iza said, is that when we look at the statistics, and there are really good studies and reports on the education of Syrian children in Turkey, is that the enrollment rates are quite high for the very young, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, and then it begins to drop as you're approaching older children. And that's a challenge. That's a major challenge. And what I like the most about the younger ones is the way in which they will enthusiastically offer their translation services, little children in the field. Yes, Afrin.
Before Afrin, let me say something about the education. We have in Turkey now between 5 to 17 years old Syrian children, over 1,070,000. And then for that, we need at least 1,300 new schools. It is not easy, actually. I think it's a big success. Now we have at about 615,000 students at the schools. It's a big success. But the quality of the education and then integration politic, it's very problematic. We have to see. And for new students, we need extra 50,000 teachers. And it costs also enormous. You can also make a calculation, at least 2 billion euros per year Turkish government should spend for the Syrian children. It is not easy, and then in short term, it is really very problematic. It is only the technical way, and the other side, the boys, they work already in Turkey. Girls, their family, they don't want to send them to school. They have also some barriers, and then they have also fear for the assimilation, actually, in Turkey. Mm-hmm. It's also another big topic. But it is the biggest problem in Turkey, and we should find any solution to send them to school. For example, only in Şanlıurfa, the need of new schools for Syrian children is 220, and then plan for next 2 years, only 14, because you cannot find easily place to make school. It is not easy process. And then in this region, the education is in general very bad, and then their condition is also very bad. It is not easy challenge for all. And then secondly, the Afrin. Of course, this is a very, very new phenomenon in Turkey. 2 months ago, I was in AK Party, Erdogan's party, in a symposium, and then we discussed how can we integrate the Syrian in the Turkey. I mean, the concept was very clear, finally, after 7 years, and then we discussed about that, education, work, et cetera, et cetera. But now, the new discourse has changed everything. And then, the operation, of course, the Turkish society gave support, because of the terrorism and then the fight to terrorism. But not only that, they hope that also after this operation, maybe the Syrian refugees can go back. That is not realistic if you look at the reality in Turkey. But the discourse will stop all the integration process in Turkey. I have a big problem for that. And then the support from the Syrian refugees to the Afrin operation and the other operation in the region is also very limited. You can see the demographic figures in Turkey. The youth, I mean the Syrian youth, they are mostly men. I mean, if you look at only age group 20-24, it is very, very strange. 100 women, but 134 men. It is the balance. I mean, it is not balance, but it is the reality. And because of that, of course, there are some groups. They were also ready to go Syria, to camp that, etc. But it's very, very difficult. And to go back voluntarily is almost impossible. And this operation would be also helpful for Erdogan and his party, and then maybe also MHP, to get some vote. It's an operation actually for 2019 election. It's also very important. I mean, but it will also helpful for the Turkish government, because the reaction of the community to the Syrian refugees is very high, and at least they have now a little bit hope. It's very important. And for the EU, securitization of the process is a reality, unfortunately. And then burden sharing among the EU is also a big problem. Mm-hmm. In EU, the number of the refugees, Syrian refugees, 970,000, and then more than 515 is only in Germany. And number two is Sweden 120,000. More than 70% of the refugees, they live in two countries. And of course, it is very problematic also in European countries to make integration policy. But they have a small advantage. They know already they will stay in Germany or Sweden or the other country. And then they began immediately for the integration policy to give them language courses, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, they have capacity. They have experience. It's also very important. You cannot compare with a Turkish case. And but it is also really very big problem, burden sharing, also responsibility sharing in EU. I mean, it is also within EU, it's also very important. And last point, very small, about the employment. As I said, the Syrians, they work already in Turkey, but they don't create any problem for the unemployment in Turkey. It's strange, but it is a reality, because they work very cheap, and they prefer some workplaces the Turks prefer not. Classic. And yeah, it's a very classic picture. And because of that, they can also not problem for the ordinary Turkish people. In next future, maybe, but now we have no problem in this sense. We have no problem for the unemployment because of the Syrian refugees.
Thank you. Thank you, Murat. We've come to the end of this panel. I hope you found it informative. As we close, I'd like to just highlight that this was an exercise to give the Turkish experience a voice, cities a voice, but I notice that in this whole exercise, sometimes the voice of Syrian refugees and their experiences, and especially their experiences in within Syria themselves, somehow need to be taken into account and incorporated. I'd like to thank Beth, thank Isa, and thank especially Murat, because I'm so impressed with the control he has over those statistics. And then he was feeling a bit nervous about English not being his first foreign language. He's a German speaking Turkish professor. Thanks a lot, Murat. Thanks to you too.